Welcome to Federal Insights for May, a discussion on artificial intelligence and data, sponsored by Hitachi Vantara Federal.
Artificial intelligence and machine learning success start with a clear idea of the problem you want to solve. Next comes the selection of data to train the algorithms to produce the desired outcomes. That often means large amounts of data and the associated data management challenges. For how one agency handles this, I spoke with NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist Dan Crichton.
To me, JPL has one of the most exciting missions that we could ever have right now, and that is, how do we begin to really more and more use data to understand our environment here on Earth, our solar system, and beyond. And we're capturing more data than we've ever captured in our history. We're increasing towards hundreds of petabytes of data. And so artificial intelligence and machine learning really are critical to helping us automate how we discover, how we extract insight, and what we can learn from our data. And that is pushing artificial intelligence and machine learning all the way out to things like our Mars rovers, out to observatories we have that are touring our planets, all the way to how we're being able to extract it and gain insight here on Earth from the data that we've captured from scientific observations. And so there's just immense, immense opportunities for us to be able to use machine learning and AI to help us better understand and employ these techniques to support our science community.
This large and growing amount of data that you mentioned, what is generating all of this data and exponential growth in it relative to the sources, say, a few years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have better instrumentation. So our instruments are producing much higher resolution data. So we have cameras that, and we see these on our cell phones that are now producing things like 8K and larger types of images. And we push those images and those capabilities out to our spacecraft, so we have better and better high definition cameras. And part of our challenge is actually we're bandwidth limited. So, you know, we may be able to put a high resolution camera at Mars, but the bandwidth link between Mars and Earth is limited. We've got communication delays, so 10 minutes or 7 minutes, they say 7 minutes a terabyte, but, you know, 10 to 20 minutes round trip to be able to move data from Earth up to the spacecraft, request that the spacecraft perform operations and then bring data down. And so these higher resolution images and high resolution data are generating enormous amounts of large, what we call data archives, as part of our science return. We see that in planetary. We're seeing that significantly in things like Earth missions. So many of our satellites, which are much closer to Earth, can generate enormous amounts of data and downlink that data to ground stations. And so we've seen orders of magnitude increase in many of our data holdings. So a good example is that in our planetary data, we returned about 4 terabytes of data from the beginning of the planetary program in the 60s to about 2000. Today, we're about two petabytes of data. So you can realize in the last 20 years, we've significantly outstripped anything we saw in the first 40 years of exploration.
And just a note on that, it strikes me that one good application for artificial intelligence would perhaps be to take a small sample of a gigantic data source and be able to tell you what it's saying or what's really in there based on a small sample, because it will have looked at the entire thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, what we're trying to do is figure out how to build representation models of our data, and then be able to, when we receive more observational data, being able to actually run that data through our models. And so, you know, we want to be able to train, machine learning, artificial intelligence models that are able to detect certain things. We need to train those models against training sets that have features that we're interested in. So it could be, you know, various kinds of landmarks on Mars. It could be some sort of transient events in astronomical images. But we need to be able to have those training sets and those models, which really help us to be able to find those features so that we can move from human-intensive processes to compute-intensive processes and really put the responsibility onto our computational infrastructures that can really be able to extract and find the kinds of details and data that we want to be able to discover that we're getting from our missions.
And with ever more data coming in from a given domain, how do you know when your training data set is complete and you can reuse it? Or do you have to constantly update the training data sets?
Yes. So we're always learning, and we're always improving them. And one of the big challenges we have in our world in science is trying to build a representation training set that really can capture the totality of what we want to be able to discover in our data. And there's tremendous training sets that are occurring in other areas. You know, people would say that there's good training sets for being able to do feature detection in images of humans and so forth. You see that on Facebook and so forth. But JPL is really unique because the kinds of phenomena that we're looking for in our targets, say if we're exploring our planetary bodies, if we're looking at our astronomical images, we're not always sure what we're looking for. So we may discover anomalies in the data and identify new features that we want to be able to look for and go back and update our training sets and improve our models. And so it's a really an iterative process of trying to actually train our models, discover new things, and reclassify the kinds of information that we've actually even seen in the past. So you can imagine that it's really this agile growing data environment coupled with machine learning. And that's the way science works. It's an evolving really discipline where you want to be able to learn new facts, and we need to feed those back then into our models in our understanding of what we understand about science.
You must have a tremendous metadata challenge too there, I guess.
We'd often say that it's all about the metadata because metadata is really key to being able to support the capture and management of your data, the search and discovery, and then really now what we would call the analytics, the machine learning, the deep learning, the different AI approaches. And you want to be able to have a sufficient amount of metadata to be able to really manage the vast sets of collections of data that you have. And we see this in many different areas that having a good metadata is really critical to be able to enable search and discovery. And then now we're seeing it with machine learning. If you don't have a good labeled data set, it's very difficult to actually perform machine learning. So there's a tremendous amount of preparation that we do to make sure that data really is what we call AI or analysis ready.
So someone, say a scientist working on a particular question or problem, and working together with a data scientist, for example, to solve it, they would have a catalog or some source of metadata to be able to locate the data they need for that problem at hand.
That's absolutely correct. And one of the things that JPL does with NASA is we participate in setting standards worldwide for planetary missions. And so we develop standard metadata structures and templates and we would say dictionaries and models that help us begin to describe the kinds of data, metadata we need to label our observations. And that's been coordinated with other space agencies around the world to make sure that we can actually develop a open science infrastructure to be able to share our data, support the discovery, and so forth. And that means having well-curated data metadata catalogs, capturing the data, and developing ways in which we can really interconnect our data to actually advance science as a part of humanity. And so metadata has been really the key that's helped us improve ways in which we can share and link data between our agencies together and really perform more integrated science.
Dan Crichton, Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We'll return with more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hitachi Vantara Federal is built to support your mission and vision. We empower federal agencies in the digital domains that matter most: the data center, tactical and strategic data operations, and digital transformation. We bring together an unmatched portfolio of edge-to-core to cloud infrastructure, AI, and analytics that enable our customers' digital missions and propel our nation forward. Let us accelerate your data journey from infrastructure to advanced analytics. Contact Hitachi Vantara Federal today at HitachiVantaraFederal.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Dan Crichton, Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Our topic is data management for artificial intelligence and machine learning. And the other side of data, of course, is the storage and the whole architecture for physically housing it to make it available. Maybe describe how you approach that.
Most definitely, and in fact, we look at this as the need to be able to separate our metadata, which has catalogs and search engines and so forth. So we're all used to using things like Google, which then point to the physical data itself, and that physical data itself can reside in things like cloud infrastructures. And so we more and more are using Amazon and Google Cloud and Azure and other cloud infrastructures to be able to store physically store our data and have our metadata point to that. And that's been really critical to us as we're seeing our data sets grow to the petascale kind of level, is to be able to have places where we can store and really scale up the storage infrastructures. And the challenges we have with missions, scale is certainly one of them in size, but complexity really becomes the other piece. And that's why we need to have the metadata piece to be able to describe all the data that we're getting. We often say for planetary data that we've got approximately 4,000 types of data observations that we've brought in over the years. And so you want to be able to describe that complexity, and then you want to be able to scale up the data infrastructures, the storage infrastructures that we have in place, and be able to point to that. And so we've been taking advantage of being able to build larger and larger data infrastructures, being able to capture raw data, process data, and now what we're seeing is the need to be able to capture data more for machine learning and artificial intelligence, and to be able to even capture things like the models that are supporting them. So we have an ever-expanding storage base of data, and this is going to become the permanent record of what we've learned from our missions. And so it's very important that we treat that as a long-term archive, that we put in good practices of how we actually do quality checking of that data, that we look at ways in which we can ensure the integrity of it long-term, and that we really treat it as the golden assets of our space age.
And with all of these different commercial clouds holding different sets of data, then in many ways your archive is a virtual piece. And so you need to have some kind of brokering among the clouds. And that's one question. And the other question is, how do you get control over the costs of data removal from clouds when they need data for an application?
Definitely. And in fact, you know, bringing up the virtual piece, the way that we really look at the data returned is it's often captured and stewarded by experts. So we often work very, very closely with the science community to make sure that the data itself is captured in ways that can be scientifically useful. Many of those data are put into data archives and repositories that are managed and under the stewardship of the science community. And so they are distributed, they are captured in different environments, and we stitch that together virtually to really create a distributed, integrated virtual archive. And what we see happening is not only this going on in the United States, but opportunities to really connect and support linking of these archives internationally, so that we've got an internationally virtually connected infrastructure. And so there's been consortiums set up in astronomy and earth science and in planetary science. I've particularly been instrumental in helping to set up what's known as the International Planetary Data Alliance, which connects all the archives together from our colleagues at different space agencies around the world. There's a version of that also for astronomy called the International Virtual Observatory Alliance. And really these lay down standards of how you can connect and support working with all of that data, which has really been key to making sure that the science community can access, use that data, and that we can share data from repositories without moving it around. Because once you get to sort of the petascale of data volumes and data collections, it's very difficult to move a lot of that data down. And then part of the challenge, as you mentioned too, is that as you put these into cloud infrastructures, you really want to begin to look at how you move compute to the cloud itself. So downloading all that data, being able to bring it down, it has cost implications, it has performance implications, and so we're moving into this era of how do we begin to more and more compute on the edge. So as we have growing volumes, petascale volumes, you want to really be able to bring the algorithms to the data, be able to reduce that data where it's hosted, so physically in the cloud, physically at our storage and data centers, and begin to really return a reduced result of doing that computation and processing. processing, rather than moving those terabytes or larger sets of data down to a local compute host and then running all your algorithms there.
In other words, you just get the answer back from the cloud, so to speak, whereas the logic and the data are resident in a cloud.
That's correct. And in fact, we see that same phenomena with our deep space missions, where we want to be able to more and more do extreme computing at the edge and get the answer back from our missions, rather than bringing all the data back and computing that answer on the ground. And that has tremendous benefits to being able to reduce the amount of data that's being transferred over our networks, and increases our performance, particularly for deep space missions, which are fairly far away from Earth, so that we can really make more autonomous decisions quickly. And we're seeing that both here on the ground in cloud computing, but we're seeing a version of that in the whole way in which we architect space missions. And so it's actually a pretty interesting future for us to be able to look at how do we begin to push and think about AI machine learning in this distributed world that is now moving out towards the universe.
Universe sounds like a good word for it. And another question, just with respect to supercomputers, which are on the ground, are you able to replicate supercomputer functionality when that's needed? Can that be done by a cloud?
So we're seeing versions of that where we're scaling computation, particularly to be certain kinds of embarrassingly parallel kinds of applications, which we can run very nicely in the cloud, that we can apply computational power, so forth. For machine learning AI, some of our neural networks can scale very nicely with GPU devices and computers. So we can set those up in the cloud, and then we still run things like large climate simulations and models on supercomputers. What's shifting is really the need to begin to bring, the computational power, the data, and the algorithms all together in an architecture where these can be run. And so it's rethinking of our supercomputers as ways in which they can be part of this larger compute architecture, rather than what we've done historically, which is let's move we call it a compute job to a supercomputer, have it get processed, and then move the result back. We really want to make that part of the computational infrastructure so that data can flow through. And we see that with clouds now, where we want to be able to bring data down, run it through what we would call a various workflow that computes the results we want with the high-end computing, and then makes that part of a larger data infrastructure where you can come and get that data and do the science all together. So moving to an era of how do we bring all the pieces together in a way that really can harness the power of the data and the power of machine learning AI with high-end computing.
Dan Crichton, Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We'll return with the third and final segment of this interview after a short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hitachi Vantara Federal is built to support your mission and vision. We empower federal agencies in the digital domains that matter most: the data center, tactical and strategic data operations, and digital transformation. We bring together an unmatched portfolio of edge-to-core to cloud infrastructure, AI, and analytics that enable our customers' digital missions and propel our nation forward. Let us accelerate your data journey from infrastructure to advanced analytics. Contact Hitachi Vantara Federal today at hitachivantarafederal.com.
Welcome back to the third and final segment of our interview with Dan Crichton, Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We've been discussing data management for artificial intelligence and machine learning. And what about the differentials in formats? Because you mentioned many sources of data, some of it's imagery, some of it might be weather type of data, some of it might be whatever is out there in the universe that you're observing. But it's not all the same format. It's not all JPEGs, for example. And how does that figure the whole equation?
Yes, good question. This, I believe, is the big one of the big challenges we have in science, and it's not just, I think, unique to science. We see this in many areas of different sensors, different observatories that can capture data, that may return data from different formats. And what is exciting for where we're going is the ability to be able to link that data together and to create and to fuse that data. And move from not just looking at analysis of one data set, but doing sort of multi-data set analysis, where we're linking and gaining insight. But the challenge, as you've mentioned, is that the formats are different, so we need to begin working to standardize our formats. We need to be able to provide ways in which we can fuse even different measurements from different instruments, because often you need to go through some mathematical calculations to make sure that you can do the appropriate fusion of that data and support creating a more integrated record of measurement that really can span multiple instruments. And so there's a lot of computation involved and a lot of work to look at how do we begin to provide ways in which you can not only get to the data, but ensure you can analyze the data and even link it together and gain insight. And we see that in looking at things like imaging data with elevation data and other things where we want to create a more sophisticated data record that helps us understand the data the better. And it's really important to make sure that we can link that together and create what we would call a resulting product, which is got excellent interest by our science community. We call this a level 4 product, where you can come in and actually really be able to work with that data, have it, say, for Earth gridded on the appropriate spatial grids, and be able to actually really be able to put that into a analysis environment where you can look at this geospatially.
And maybe if you could just give us some examples of AI or ML projects that are going on that you're aware of that are particularly exciting.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most extreme examples, which I really have loved, is, you know, we get dust storms on Mars, and so we've got trained models that we actually upload to our rovers. They're able to do detection and actually see these dust storms directly on the rover. And so we're actually looking to doing image analysis. We're finding features of those images, and we're able to do it right there. That's as opposed to, we talked about this earlier, so that's the result of being able to downlink it versus bringing back all that imaging data and then trying to look at it on the ground. So we're seeing automation of finding features of images. We're also bringing those kinds of capabilities back to Earth, where we're training our search engines so that we can find those geological features on planets. So being able to find craters, for example, on the moon, being able to find some of those features there. Our astronomy data, we're looking for what we call transit events. These are things that go bang in the night, quasars and other galaxy formations, things like that, where we want to find those kinds of features in our images, and we want to be able to train our models to find those features so that it doesn't need to be done by a human. And what we're seeing now is where we used to see tens of these a night, we're going to be moving to ground-based observatories. We'll see millions of these a night. So machine learning AI is going to help us scale how we can really find features in these kinds of images and get the science out that we're really looking for. So we're excited about that.
Is there any single technological piece that you would like to have that is not quite there yet?
That's a really great question. One of the things that we're really interested in, and we talked about edge computing earlier, is how can we begin to move to train our models on spacecraft, AI models? One of the challenges is that you often need a lot of data, you need a lot of compute power, and you need to be able to train this data. And we're just not there yet. Our computational infrastructures on spacecraft are not as capable as your iPhone. So they need to be running in these radiation-hardened environments. And so we're looking at how do we start to develop next-generation spacecraft, which really can support taking advantage in using AI machine learning. So moving a lot of the power that we have here on Earth into space, and that's going to open up tremendous doors for how we do things like autonomous missions and missions which really can begin to think more and more for themselves.
Dan Crichton, Program Manager and Principal Computer Scientist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. To hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for May, a discussion on artificial intelligence and data, sponsored by Hitachi Vantara Federal on Federal News Network.
Hitachi Vantara Federal is built to support your mission and vision. We empower federal agencies in the digital domains that matter most, the data center, tactical and strategic data operations, and digital transformation. We bring together an unmatched portfolio of edge-to-core to cloud infrastructure, AI, and analytics that enable our customers' digital missions and propel our nation forward. Let us accelerate your data journey from infrastructure to advanced analytics. Contact Hitachi Vantara Federal today at HitachiVantaraFederal.com.